From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with master film editor Dee Dee Allen. She's edited such films as The Hustler, Bonnie and Clyde, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, Reds, and The Wonder Boys, which has just been re-released. Also, we meet clarinetist and composer Andy Biskin. He's just released his first CD. He takes old music like polkas, marches, and parlor songs and puts a new spin on them. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest album from PJ Harvey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The seven justices of Florida's Supreme Court are still deliberating over whether hand recounts now underway in three counties should be included in the state's presidential totals. A spokesman for the court said the justices were at work this evening and that he didn't know when they would issue a ruling. Earlier today, lawyers for Texas Governor George Bush filed a brief with the court saying the justices do not have the power to determine which ballots should or should not be tallied in the hand recount. That came after Gore's legal team asked the court to set a standard for vote counting in all three counties. Nebraska Senator Bob Kerrey says Republicans who charge that military absentee ballots are being unfairly discarded are playing politics with the U.S. military. NPR's Philip Davis reports from Miami.
Republican officials, such as Congressman John Sweeney of New York, have been charging that military ballots are being rejected in unusually high numbers, mainly because they have no postmarks to prove that they were mailed in time. Though Attorney General Bob Butterworth yesterday said ballots could be counted as long as they were dated in any way, Sweeney reiterated the charges again today, even alleging that the military controversy showed Al Gore was not fit to be commander-in-chief. Kerry, a war veteran, angrily rebutted the charges.
Please don't stand out here and say that votes are being stolen or the vice president is not fit to be commander-in-chief or there's fraud going on or votes being manufactured. That simply isn't true.
In Miami, elections officials said few military ballots had dates other than postmarks, but if they did, they would be accepted. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Two major U.S. airlines are using legal action to head off flight delays during the busy holiday travel season. Both United and Northwest Airlines are blaming higher-than-normal flight cancellations on work slowdowns by mechanics. Jason DeRose reports from Chicago Public Radio.
The union is asking to be released from federal mediation so it can legally strike after a 30-day cooling-off period. United mechanics have been working without a contract since July. But officials at the nation's largest airline say they want to get back to the negotiating table with the union as soon as possible. United Mechanics union representatives and corporate officials of the Chicago-based airline are in Washington this week to talk separately with the Federal Mediation Board. If the mediation board grants the strike and a 30-day cooling-off period, United Mechanics would be off the job by December 20th, just in time for the busy Christmas travel weekend. Last Friday, a judge issued a temporary restraining order preventing mechanics from refusing overtime, staging a labor slowdown, and sending aircraft in for unnecessary repairs. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 32 points to close at 10,494 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 4 points to close at 2871. This is NPR News. The death toll in the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis has risen to at least 247 following the killings of an Israeli and a Palestinian today. Israeli soldiers killed a Palestinian intelligence officer, saying he was shot as he approached a Jewish settlement in a suspicious manner. Palestinians later ambushed an Israeli car in the Gaza Strip, killing the driver. Egypt has recalled its ambassador from Israel to protest yesterday's Israeli rocket attacks on Palestinian targets in Gaza. The city of Buffalo is under a state of emergency. All non-essential travel is banned following an early season storm that dumped 2 feet of snow. Mark Scott reports from member station WBFO.
The National Guard is assisting city crews in removing snow from Buffalo's clogged streets. Hampering the effort is hundreds of cars that were abandoned by motorists. Some people were forced to spend more than 16 hours in traffic jams. National Weather Service meteorologist Tom Nizial said yesterday's snowstorm was expected, but not the intensity.
During those daytime hours when everybody was already at work, all the kids were already at school, the storm hit, and it hit with a very ferocious intensity.
2,000 Buffalo school students were forced to spend the night in churches, community centers, and hospitals after their buses weren't able to bring them home. For NPR News, I'm Mark Scott in Buffalo.
The high cost of foreign oil helped swell the U.S. trade deficit to a record high in September. The Commerce Department reported that the gap between what Americans import and what the U.S. sells overseas grew to more than $34 billion. That's up by 15% from the month before. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dee Dee Allen, is considered a master film editor. One of her achievements is editing the classic pool shark movie, The Hustler.
Two ball, side pocket. Very good shot. You know, I got a hunch, fat man. I got a hunch it's me from here on in. One ball, corner pocket. I mean, that ever happened to you? All of a sudden you feel like you can't miss? Because I dreamed about this game, fat man. I dreamed about this game every night on the road. Five ball. No, this is my table, man. I own it.
13 ball. 7 ball. 4 ball.
Game.
That was Paul Newman and Jackie Gleason. Some of the other films Dee Dee Allen has edited include Odds Against Tomorrow, Bonnie and Clyde, Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, Night Moves, The Missouri Breaks, Reds, The Breakfast Club, The Addams Family, and The Wonder Boys, which has just been re-released. She received the 1999 Career Achievement Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. She was the first editor to ever receive this honor. Editing is essential in shaping the narrative and rhythm of a film, yet we often aren't conscious of it. But in the film Bonnie and Clyde, the editing of the final shootout was remarkable. The two bank robbers were hit with dozens of bullets, and we saw their bodies twitch and jump with the impact of each hit. Adding to the impact were the rapid edits that conveyed the fury of the bullets and also showed the action at varying speeds. It's always interested me about that scene. There's really so little blood for so many bullet holes. It's almost as if there's a double standard in what violence was acceptable, that the bullets were okay, but not the blood.
Well, an interesting thing, which is a parallel thing to this, is when we saw it, it was at a preview, and Arthur almost died because everything was so bloody and so red. And I spent 11 more days at Technicolor to get the tone that Arthur wanted. I mean, he was just distraught. It was a great preview. You know, it saved our lives, that preview. But the color was pretty heavy and dense, and the blood was very, very dark. And I don't know how that quite relates to the bullets, but certainly I don't think Arthur was ever interested in having violent blood spurting out, unless there was a real reason for it, because basically this was a film that he made after the Kennedy assassination. And I've always felt that that last scene was a kind of a symbolic scene about the violence in America, which of course still exists.
You're one of the first successful women film editors. How did you first get your foot in the door in the 1940s?
Well, I was going to college at a place called Scripps College in Claremont, California. I'm not from California, but that's where I went to college. And between my sophomore and junior year, it was 1943, the middle of the war. Faith Elliott Hubley and I were the first two girl messengers hired at Columbia when the guys went off to war that summer. And I never finished college. I just stayed messenger for 10 months, and that was 4 years in sound before I ever got a chance to touch picture. And I never did that in the 4 years at Columbia. I was a sound effects editor, and I think that has a lot to do with whatever rhythm people say I have.
So how do you think learning to edit sound effects influenced you as a film editor?
Oh, I think tremendously, because I have no fear of sound. I worked when it was optical. You used to look at the stuff and see it. And then later, when we went to MAG when I was in New York, you know, it's just as easy. You just learn a different, you don't look at it. You just hear it. And sound has always been very important. It is very important to me. I don't like to show even a first cut unless it plays sound-wise. And, of course, in those days, it was hard to make it play sound-wise because you had one track. You didn't have two or three tracks. You didn't have an Avid or any of those things.
An Avid is a digital system of editing.
It's a digital system, yes. Although it goes to film ultimately, you know, when you screen and you go to prints, you're cutting on numbers and little pieces of information which come out as a picture.
When you were first learning how to edit film, were there certain rules that you were told were basically unbreakable that you've subsequently broken?
Oh, yes. I remember one man, a very, very generous man, who was doing Ann Miller pictures, and he took me in and said, I want to teach you something. He said, you always start with a long shot, then you move in to an over-shoulder or a group shotter. And he said, and you never change that order. Of course, when I started cutting in the years in New York before I could get features, I was working in what was called a spot house, and I was doing industrials and things. And somehow or other, I was breaking that rule constantly. I was doing medical films where, you know, I just didn't seem to think about that way. When I got a chance to cut for Bob Wise, I was terrified. He was, after all, Orson Welles' editor, and, you know, and I was very impressed. This was the first picture he also was in charge of producing. It was Harry Belafonte was producing a picture called Odds Against Tomorrow, 1959, and I was by then 34 years old, and I had started when I was 18, so that's was a long route to get there. But the first Saturday that I ever showed Bob Wise my first scene, it was a scene up on Riverside Drive in a clunky apartment where Ed Begley and Robert Ryan first meet with Harry Belafonte, and Robert Ryan plays a very racist bank robber. And I worked that scene over and over and over again. And in those days, you had hot splicers, meaning big foot splicers, where if you lost a frame, you had to slug it in black. And so the first sequence that I showed him, it had what I used to call little blackies in them, you know, little black slugs in them. And he looked at the scene and he punched me on the arm and says, good girl, I like to see you've been working with that. Never be afraid. I said, oh, I was so afraid. All my mistakes would show. He says, no. He says, you've been working the scene. It wasn't like a time now where, with the Avid or something, where you can do it any one of a dozen ways and nobody sees your mistakes. He was just so encouraging. I mean, I couldn't have had a better mentor as my first big feature.
If you're just joining us, my guest is film editor Dee Dee Allen. Among the many films she's edited include The Hustler, Bonnie and Clyde, Little Big Man, Dog Day Afternoon, Reds, The Addams Family, and the current film The Wonder Boys. She received the 1999 Career Achievement Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. She's the first editor to get that honor. Let me ask you about the film The Hustler, one of the early films you edited. This is the 1961 classic about pool hustlers starring Paul
right.
Newman, George C. Scott, and Jackie Gleason. It was directed by Robert Rawson. In the pool scenes, there's a real great rhythm between the pool shots, the view of the table, and the cutaways to the reactions of the players and the spectators. And in some scenes, the pace seems to just escalate as the game goes on and tension increases. Can you describe your approach to editing those pool sequences through the film?
Yes, actually, the pool sequences were the first things that were shot. We were in Ames Pool Hall for a long time, and I was back in my cutting room, cutting it. And when we shot what became montages, and even the ones that weren't montages, as the pace increased in that whole sequence at the beginning of the first big game that Minnesota Fats wins, it was long. but it played. This is the point I think I'm trying to make. It played long. And then when we started montaging it, I would take the black and white without even going to what was then called a fine grain, which was a way you would put it out in a black and white film. Ultimately, you would go to a finer grain and then re-photograph it from that. I would take the black and white and do what I call quick and dirty montages. And that's the manner in which we did the first one. Once it was, say, a full reel, and I got it down to then a half a reel, and then, you know, this is for each montage. Some of the montages were faster. It was a process. It's all a process. But if a scene played, Rawson would tell me, well, it's kind of a, he said, don't pish in the mustard. It's kind of a dirty expression. I don't know if you can use that. Don't improve it into a disaster. But he was a fantastic story man. I mean, he really knew. We would switch scenes around. We would go up and just switch scenes, play them differently. And we had to lose one of the best scenes that Paul was just heartbroken in the pool hall because it was very similar to what the story told in another scene. And even though it was, as far as Paul was concerned, a better scene for performance, it had to go. And that was the kind of thing Rawson was good at. We just never had a chance to totally finish the cutting down. And as I said, sometimes he didn't want refining scenes.
Who explained to Paul Newman that the scene had to go even though he loved it? Did you
oh,
have
probably
to do that?
Rawson.
You were spared from that yourself.
No, I didn't. I mean, you know, he came to all the dailies, and well, I could tell. I'm sure Paul wouldn't mind if I told this funny story on Rawson. He would sit with me, and Paul would come up afterwards, and he'd start telling me how he felt about the scene, what he wanted. And then Rawson once said to me, never pay attention, because he wants Eddie Felsen to be a good guy. Actually, he's not a good guy. Bobby Darin could have played him. You know, he's that kind of a bad guy. And he says he wants him, because he's such a good person himself, he wanted Eddie Felsen to be nicer than he really was.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Does it ever happen that you have a scene, and no matter how many takes you did, there was always one actor for whom the scene worked and another actor that wasn't at their best, and in the final...
happens all the time.
Yeah, and in the final edit, you have to decide which actor is going to get their good performance in the scene and who's going to get their...
I don't think you think of it as an actor whose good performance is there. I think you have to protect actors always. I'm a great believer in never allowing even fine actors sometimes have tics that they do. They don't even know they do. You know, and once in a while I see them in a movie and I think, Jesus, why did the editor not, you know, help that actor a little? That's not, I think, what you do. You play the scene for the scene, and if there's a weak actor generally, you just play it slightly differently. You know going in that you've seen the dailies enough. I memorize all my footage, and I put them all in a certain order and memorize them, and I know where the weak parts and the strong parts are. And if you don't have all equal actors, you wouldn't even think of trying to do that unless it helped the scene to do that on occasion, you know, or once in a while you'll use a mistake or something that isn't quite right to make a point. It just completely depends. Always a matter of choice when you're starting. How do you decide who to play what line on?
You know,
I'm not intellectual that way. I don't sit down and graph it out. I go completely by gut.
So you like to be at the rehearsals if possible. You like to be on the set. You like to see the dailies. Do you ever worried that will influence your decision that in other words, that when you're actually editing a movie, that a scene might look different than your memory of it or than the way it played on the set, and that you'll be kind of too influenced by the way it played on the set?
Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question, because actually I don't like to be on the set. I don't want to know who's fighting with who's screwing who. I don't want to know any of that. That doesn't interest me in any way. I'm only on the set when I'm called on the set. Otherwise, I don't really go on the set. I never go on the set. Because I like to look at the film, and for me, it's fresh.
Right.
And I don't have to know any of the baggage that goes with making it.
My guest is film editor Dee Dee Allen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film editor Dee Dee Allen. Her movies include The Hustler, Bonnie and Clyde, Dog Day Afternoon, Reds, and The Wonder Boys, which has just been re-released. What should a good editor do to watch out for an actor?
Well, you just don't put anything. You never make an actor look. For instance, if a woman is going up a staircase and there's a camera following her, and it's someone who's being photographed, even if they have a very slender figure, sometimes they can look a little wobbly in the rear end. You would never put a shot like that. And I've sometimes seen things like that where actors weren't protected as much as they could, or an actor has a bad tick in you, or they take a breath, or they take that pause that you know is a preparation. And I've sometimes seen those left in films. And that's someone who just didn't know that they could get rid of that and not and cover it and not show where an actor basically paused because they were doing a prep. You have to know when they're really into the character and when they're not. It's a matter of knowing good acting, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You've seen the technology of film editing change a lot since the 1940s when you started as an apprentice. Tell us how you made an edit when you first started and how you make them now. Digitally.
Well, when you first start, you make an edit on film. You cut it on a splicer, and the splices have all changed, too, because they used to be, or you do it with a scissor. I beg your pardon. I haven't gone back far enough. You do it with a scissor, and you would lose one side of the frame. You would lose a frame between each cut. Mm-hmm. And so you had to put... There are some even, I think, in 16mm when you would lose two frames. I can't quite remember, but that's what I meant when I was talking about the Bob Wise first scene I ever cut.
Right.
If you lost the frame, you had to slug it, and you would slug it in black because that shows better than white. You wouldn't slug it in white because that would flash bright. So you would see the thing chatter with these little black things going through. I remember at Columbia where I first started, I never got into the picture department there, but I remember before preview, there would be these, I would go up sometimes and be called in to help clean the film. They would clean the film within an inch of its life and replace any slug that was in it for the preview. And you would have your hand in a big double tin of carbon tet, which became very dangerous later. And you would squeegee it through velvets very, very slowly to clean it up for the picture.
Carbon tet is like a dry cleaning fluid.
Yeah, well, it's something used to be used for cleaning film, but it's a noxious one. I mean, it's not, you can get very sick from it.
Right.
But we didn't know that in those days.
And now you're editing digitally.
Now I'm editing digitally. Then there was the period when you had tape, of course. You spliced it, and then you had the period of the Carlos Rivas, which is a straight splicer where you only have to put one sprocket. And then Walter Murch developed one where you only had to put a half a sprocket, a little tiny thing where you never saw the tape. I mean, each generation contributes. It's wonderful.
Did you ever find yourself resisting change and preferring it the old way, or did you go along with all the changes and welcome them?
You can't work in this industry if you resist change. I happen to love equipment. I mean, when I lived with my grandparents the last 3 years of high school, I would fix the plumbing and stuff like that. My grandfather was a surgeon. He wouldn't touch anything like that. So I was always had fun with my mechanically, so I had no trouble with moviolas and things like that because mechanically I kind of liked them.
When you started off in movies, you were hoping to one day direct, but you stayed in film editing. What did you love and what do you love about editing films?
It's a very exciting profession because you really get to play other characters. You get into a story and that story becomes real to you. Sometimes at the expense of your own family, to be honest. And I suppose it's like an escape. I think movies were always an escape for me. And it's an escape into something that I was so privileged to be allowed to get into and to do. And I was always so grateful for the opportunity of getting that I never got tired of it. But also my husband in a different field, he was in news and public affairs, he became a director. He was a writer who became a director and producer and so forth. And there came a period in our lives when our children were teenagers where I would never have thought of, I had a chance to start directing maybe twice that were a real chance. And I decided it was not the time to start competing. A marriage, when both people are working, is competitive enough. And at that point, I just, then maybe it was too late in my career. It was, I was probably in my, well into my 50s before I got my first chance.
Now, you told us that at the beginning of the career, where you first got into the editing room was, it was during the war, and a lot of men...
Second World War.
Yeah, and a lot of men...
We have to say that these days.
And a lot of men who had had jobs were off fighting the war, so there were more openings. Do you think anything was more difficult for you as a woman? Were there any obstacles put before you? Were people willing to mentor you in spite of the fact that you were a woman?
That's a word that wasn't used in those days. Nobody... I used it... In terms of, I think I used it earlier in the interview, because I've heard it so much lately.
Right.
Obviously, there are people who encourage you. I mean, I never would have been able to get ahead in anything, because I was working mostly with men, unless the men who helped me were encouraging. I mean, that's, as far as I'm concerned, it took in my generation, certainly, men to help women. You just couldn't go blasting your way. After all, you had to... The hardest thing to do is to be able to learn everything of what goes on in a laboratory and not be considered, an overbearing ball buster is the word they used to use. I guess they still do. They use worse words now. Anyway, it's very hard to retain yourself as a woman and still be knowledgeable. And the only way you can do that is to learn everything you have to know about everything so that nobody can fool you. And laboratories were a wonderful place because I ended up with great relationships with people in labs because I had come from having cut commercials and industrials and laying out my own opticals. So I knew labs and I knew the people who did the opticals and I knew what you could do. And when you know your stuff, they respect you. They don't think of you as a man or a woman, but it took in every new relationship in the early days, it took going through that period of their learning that I really didn't know what I was talking about. So you had to work harder. I think it's as simple as that. I'm not sure that isn't still true today. I don't know.
Film editor Dee Dee Allen. She's now editing the film John Q, starring Denzel Washington, directed by Nick Cassavetes. She recently edited the film Wonder Boys, which has just been re-released. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with clarinetist and composer Andy Biskin. He puts a new spin on polkas, marches, and parlor songs. We're listening to his quintet now. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from PJ Harvey. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A few weeks ago, our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviewed the debut CD of clarinetist and composer Andy Biskin. We liked the music so much, we started playing it on the show. Then we decided to invite Biskin to talk with us about it. As Kevin said, Biskin's compositions recall early jazz and old social music. Short solos alternate with tightly arranged passages. The rhythm section sometimes plays two-beat oompa rhythms. And his quintet has a trumpet, clarinet, and trombone front line, like an old New Orleans jazz band. Even so, the sound he gets from those old ingredients is quite fresh. Biskin's new CD, Dogmental, is on GM Records, the label founded by composer and conductor Gunther Schuller, who praises Biskin's originality and sophisticated humor. Here's Biskin's composition, Sad Commentary. Things you do as an arranger and composer that I like is that, you know, you take the tune that you wrote and you very quickly put it through different distortions and permutations. In fact, you know, I was listening to your record while watching the timer just to see, like, because I sometimes do that for the show. We might play a minute or a minute and a half or something. And by the time you're like 40 seconds into one of your tracks, it's often gone through like two or three different permutations.
I think I'm approaching composition as an improviser because I spent a lot of time improvising before I ever attempted to write music. And when I'm writing music, I try to be in that sort of mindset where you just write down the first thing that comes into your head. You know, maybe I actually, if I'm looking for the next thing to do, I just start playing the song and say, well, if I was playing a solo on this song, what would I do next? And so I try to capture that spontaneity and then fix it on paper.
I'm interested too in the speed in which the changes happen. I mean, it's what can I say? Short attention span music in the best sense of the word.
Yeah, I agree. And I am maybe because I have a short attention span, and I go hear a lot of music, and I get bored. I'm really happy at the beginning of the tune when you're hearing the stuff that was written out, and then there's all these long solos, and I'm kind of wishing that more stuff was written out. So I guess I'm catering to someone like me that's sitting in the audience that wants things to keep changing. And in the old days, people probably could concentrate for much longer, but not me.
In the liner notes for your new CD, you talk about when you were young and you had a band, and you bought a sheet music book featuring the music of Harry L. Alford's Hungry Five. This sounds like a really odd little book of sheet music and 22 sets of wisecracks plus additional patter. What was this about? It had wisecracks in it for you to learn?
Well, this was music that Mr. Alford put out, I guess, in the early 50s. And I stumbled upon it by accident. I was rummaging through the local music store, and I was in my high school band, and I was looking for some other kind of band that I could start on my own. And they're funny little arrangements. I a lot of it's oompa-pa music, waltzes, polkas, and things. And there was actually another book that I found that had more interesting arrangements, that had arrangements of classical tunes, overtures and waltzes. There was the Poet and Peasant Overture, Merry Wives of Windsor. the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies. And there's something kind of nice about this combination of two clarinets, trumpet, trombone, and tuba. It's sort of like taking a concert band and shrinking it to the very smallest essence that you could have. And there's something kind of naive and charming about thinking about this little miniature band trying to play Tchaikovsky or von Suppe, and I like that. So I got some like-minded souls from the high school band, and we used to have rehearsals in the living room, and eventually we had a band, and we got some little gigs and figured out some shtick. I guess the idea of the Hungry Five was that you would play a polka, and then you would tell these horrible jokes, and then play another polka, and we tried doing some of that. The jokes never really went over very well, but they were there.
Did you use jokes from the Harry Alford songbook?
We did. It was jokes like, "I hear your landlord's going to raise your rent." Well, that's good because I certainly can't raise it. That kind of stuff.
Oh, boy. not good. Were you the one who had to tell the jokes?
Well, we assigned, there were different parts, and, each person took on one of the voices. And when I was writing the liner notes for the album, I was thinking about where this combination of trumpet, trombone, and clarinet came from. It is the front line of a Dixieland band, but I realized that really the way I had gotten the sound into my head was from the old Hungry Five. So I went back and actually, for some reason I'd saved this music, and I looked it up, and there in pencil were all of our phone numbers and little notes between the tunes about who was going to tell which joke and everything. It was all there, and it really took me back.
Who are you performing for then? I mean, this is the era where people had garage bands, not...
Well, we played at some, like, PTA meetings. We played at, parties that our parents were giving.
Are you suggesting that nobody your age wanted to hear the music?
Well, there was one funny thing that happened. I grew up in San Antonio, and there's a big Latino population. And somehow we ended up playing on the talent show for Lanier High School, which was basically a Mexican-American high school. And we got out there in our lederhosen, and we started playing this polka, and everybody in the audience went wild. I mean, it turns out that polka is a big part of conjunto music, and they related to it in a way that we didn't. And it was suddenly, we thought that we were going to, they'd be throwing tomatoes at us, and they loved it.
My guest is clarinetist and composer Andy Biskin. His new CD is called Dog Mental. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andy Biskin. He's a clarinetist and composer, and his new CD, his first, is called Dog Mental. Let's hear another track from the CD, and this is called Flim Flam, and I really like it a lot. It's kind of circusy and marching bandish. Let's give it a listen. Thank you. Anything in particular inspire that composition?
Well, I think there's some Nina Rota there. There's definitely, I mean, it's sort of a, like a, I think of it as a little miniature film score or something. I'm not sure where it came from. It just, it was one of these tunes that just came to me very quickly. And, you know, I started writing it. I wasn't even sure what key it was in. You know, I said, now I got to write a bass line to it. And I'm still not really sure what key it's in, but I like the idea of going to this waltz in the middle of it. I had this waltz that I was trying to figure out something to do with, and I thought, well, let's let the song just kind of fall apart and get quiet, and suddenly we'll be in the waltz for a while, and then we'll go back to the march.
Were you in a marching band when you were young?
Oh, yes. In my high school, the music program centered around the marching band. The reason that there was a music program was because it was an adjunct to the football team. So I was out there at 7:30 in the morning during football season marching, and I hated it. I really did. But one thing about the band program is that you get exposed to a lot of different kinds of music, and you know we played a lot of adaptions of classical pieces and these kind of contemporary weird things that people were writing for modern bands, and then some of the classics, the Sousa marches. So it was fun, and I think that it was a big influence on me.
Yeah, do you think playing in band gave you an affection for marches that you might otherwise not have had?
Yeah, I have to say one thing is that my father was a musician. We were not a family that was into sports, but he would watch football and he would kind of sleep through the game, and when the halftime show came on, he'd turn up the volume, everyone would have to be silent, and he was into bands, he was into parades, and I think I got some of that from him.
How did clarinet become your instrument? Were you assigned it in school?
Well, it was chosen for me by my parents, and I'm not sure I didn't have much to do with that decision, but I came home from school one day and there was a clarinet sitting on my bed, and my father announced that this was going to be my instrument, and you know, I said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "This is a clarinet." So I accepted that. I was 9 years old. I liked the way it looked, I liked the way it sounded, and you know, soon I was taking lessons from one of the clarinetists in the orchestra, and working my way through the method books and scales and arpeggios and etudes. But I don't really remember not playing the clarinet. It's something that's always been there.
Did you ever ask your father why he thought clarinet should be your instrument?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't like they had done this in-depth study about it. I think you could buy a clarinet for not much money. They liked the sound of it. It wasn't as annoying as the violin. You could play in the band. You could play in a symphony. There was a good teacher in town. I think also they thought that it somehow fit my personality.
Now, you have a forthcoming CD that features mostly songs by Stephen Foster. And I'm wondering what it's been like for you to go back to songs from the early days of American popular song and play them and rearrange them.
It's been a really incredible experience. I've been writing my own music for a long time, and I never really have attempted to arrange anybody else's music. I was doing a gig once with a piano player, and we were just leafing through a songbook, and we came upon Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair, and we played it, and I said, "Well, this is a beautiful song," and there's something about these tunes. They're like folk songs, except they all happen to be written by the same person. They were all written in the 1860s, and they're so ingrained in our unconscious that you can do so much with them, and they still maintain their identity. I do this version of Old Folks at Home that is a little bit out there, but somehow, you know, the song still comes through.
Did you like Stephen Foster songs as a kid, or did you just consider them to be cliches or old-fashioned?
I did consider them to be cliches, and it was something that I think I really didn't appreciate until I was an adult. But you know, I'm interested in the idea of a musical cliche. That's something that really fascinates me. I have this book called I forgot. It's the Book of World Famous Music by James J. Fould, and it's an incredible book. It's like the canon of every familiar melody that we have in our heads here is in Western civilization. It has everything from, you know, Three Blind Mice, What Do You Say to a Drunken Sailor, plus a lot of classical stuff, Fair Elise, Santa Lucia, For He's a Jolly Good Fellow, Shave and a Haircut, Two Bits. And you think about these things, and they're these melodies that have somehow survived through natural selection or something, that they're just part of our vocabulary, that are just in the air, you know, that everyone knows, and we don't even know why they're there, but if you go bump bump dump bump bump bump, everyone knows that you're referring to Shave and a Haircut, Two Bits.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing too about those old songs that are just kind of in the air, is that whether you like the song or not, there's something that a familiar line of music does to your brain that's just unique. And there's a certain pleasure in familiar music, even familiar music you don't like. So I think even if you as a composer or arranger take a piece of familiar music and you rework it in an unusual way, there's the pleasure a listener has of taking this familiar thing and making it different. But that familiar thing just gives you this common language to work with.
I think that's true, and I think that a lot of what makes a composition interesting is this whole interplay between the familiar and the new, and you know, it works in improvisation, it works in composition, but when you're playing, you're playing with people's expectations. You're giving them things that they know and understand and you know, find comfort in, but you have to keep them stimulated, and there has to be a certain amount of novelty. And I think these tunes are great for that, because everyone knows, you know, they know what's going to happen, but they don't really know how you're going to get there.
Your Stephen Foster CD is recorded, but it's not nearly ready to be released. You're actually still looking for a label to release it on. But maybe we could just play a preview of it. Do you want to choose a song?
Yeah, let's listen to Camptown Races.
And what have you done with this?
I guess it's sort of like a theme in variations. I've basically just worked my way through the tune in two or three different ways, and it has some little twists and turns, and eventually you get to the end.
Well, great. Let's hear it. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been great.
Andy Biskin's interpretation of the Stephen Foster song Camptown Races from an unreleased CD. His new CD is called Dogmental. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews PJ Harvey's new CD. This is Fresh Air. PJ Harvey, the group name for the rock band led by British singer and songwriter Polly Jean Harvey, has released its sixth CD called Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea. Harvey wrote most of the songs on this album during an extended stay in New York City. And rock critic Ken Tucker says the change of creative venue has altered the sound and mood of Harvey's music.
If you're not acquainted with Polly Jean Harvey's music, let me tell you, hearing her chant, this is love that I'm feeling, is very atypical, a bit funny, and not a little thrilling. Harvey made her reputation by playing commandingly rough lead guitar and singing eloquent feel-bad songs in either a low growl or a muttered moan. She spent the 90s being a prolific melancholic, chronicling disappointment, betrayal, and regret, and questioning, always questioning, her own motives and feelings. Not by mistake does her best album's title take the form of a question, is this desire? But Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea states Harvey's current mood very clearly. It surges with a new exhilaration and power.
Look at it.
That explosion leads off Polly Jean Harvey's new CD, and like This Is Love, its headlong music stresses the sentiment in the lyric, as Harvey yells to her lover, I'm immortal when I'm with you. Typical of her work, however, is that even in the throes of erotic bliss, she also tosses in meditations on the end of the world and the death of everyone except Polly Jean and the object of her affection. Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea isn't Harvey's best or most consistent collection. In fact, it's the first one in which this unique artist proves she's not unique, echoing on this song, for example, the tone and phrasing of Patti Smith and the Pretenders' Chrissie Hynde. Listen for them.
Through my bad fortune, off the top of a tall building, I'd rather done it with you. Your boy's smile, 5 in the morning, looked into your eyes, and I was really in love. In Chinatown, hungover, you showed me just what I could do. Talking about time travel and meaning, just what it was worth.
Stories from the City climaxes with two magnificent PJ Harvey songs, Horses in My Dreams, which moves with the slow languorousness of a late-night dream from which you cannot pull yourself free, and We Float, a composition whose unfurling beauty imbues its dime store refrain, We Float, Take Life as It Comes, with an unexpectedly deep emotionalism. Taken as a whole, Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea is like a volume of short stories that cohere as a novel of rare romantic realism.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed PJ Harvey's new CD, Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Roberta Shurrock, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You're the only story that never been told. You're my dirty little secret, wanna keep your soul. Come on out, come on over, help me forget. Keep the walls from falling as they're tumbling in. Come on out, come on over, help me forget. Keep the walls from falling as they're tumbling in. Keep the walls from falling as they're tumbling in. This is love that I'm feeling. This is love that I'm feeling. This is love that I'm feeling. This is love, love, 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 love that I'm feeling. This is love that I'm feeling.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Division, publisher of In Our Time by Susan Brown Miller, a memoir of the feminist revolution. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Then she said, oh, little strong survive. Oh, little strong survive.
On the next Fresh Air, rhythm and blues singer Jerry Butler. His new memoir has the same title as his 1968 hit, Only the Strong Survive. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.